I took a screenshot of my checking account and it was like 38 cents. In my mind, I saved $50,000. I don't think I went through $50,000 that quick. But anyway, the point is I did not have very much money.
This is Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. I've spent the past 10 years building the life and work that I love. I'm sharing what I'm learning along the way here on this show. 10 years ago, I met Rob Hunter, our guest today, in a cafe. Well, I actually met him on Craigslist, but then we met in person in a cafe, and we both had just left our jobs around the same time. We were both determined to make it on our own, and we ended up spending several months wandering from cafe to cafe in San Francisco together. And we'd put in these 12-hour days, and we wouldn't make a dime. And it was one of the most exciting times of my life and my career. And so today, I have this podcast. I have a best-selling book. I've got another book on the way. I can live wherever I want. And today, Rob is one half of a company called Focused Apps. They have hit iOS games, including Hit Tennis and Emoji Me. Emoji Me has been downloaded 40 million times. You can make an emoji that looks just like you, with an unlimited, seemingly unlimited number of facial features and things like that. Rob is also location independent. He and his wife are actually getting ready to travel around Asia pretty soon. And Rob and I both left our jobs at the same time. We both wanted to make it. You're going to see in this episode that we had two very different mindsets. We had different approaches. We had different paths. So listen to this episode to learn when you start on your own, you better have some kind of vision about where you're going. So what was it that each of us expected from the beginning? What was it that we expected to achieve? How did that end up turning out? Starting out on your own is a big risk. How did each of us think about that risk? And what did we think that our options were at the time? How did that shape our approaches? When did we finally feel like we made it? How did we finally get there? And about half of this conversation hit the cutting room floor. We pay for editing by the minutes, and I wanted to keep this conversation clean, just focused around our different approaches and paths. But in the bonus material for Love Your Work Elite members, Rob shares his lessons learned from making many, many apps that did not work and a couple that did work very well. So if you're not an LYW Elite member, of course, you can join at lywelite.com. And remember, if you sign up by October 31st, you are going to get 30% off the beautiful, soft, luxurious Love Your Work Tri-Blend t-shirt. Again, you have to join before October 31st or by October 31st at lywelite.com. And those LYW Elite members, they help make this episode free, but then again, so do our sponsors. VideoBlocks is sponsoring this episode. VideoBlocks is very cool. It's a huge library of royalty-free studio-quality video clips, and you can use these in your video projects. You can use them for backgrounds on website designs. So if you need some B-roll of the Golden Gate Bridge, they've got that. It's going to add some environment and professionalism to your video. You want a flyover the Grand Canyon, they've got that too. It can really make your video projects shine. They also have After Effects templates. You can plug in whatever text you want. You can have some really awesome kinetic typography in your video. They take care of us. Let's take care of them. Go to videoblocks.com/loveyourwork. Check it out. Try all of the stock video you can imagine for free for 7 days. That's VideoBlocks, VideoBlocks.com/loveyourwork. To save on millions of studio quality clips from VideoBlocks. And I want to make a quick shout out to a listener, Simon Dowling. Simon recommended Love Your Work over on Instagram. He said, I've been listening to a great podcast lately called Love Your Work by @Cadavy. It's incredible for all creatives and entrepreneurs. I lost a bit of motivation with my drawings lately, but this podcast is helping me get back on track. Thank you so much, Simon. Simon drew this really awesome Love Your Work lettering. And you can check out his work at Simon_Dowling on Instagram. Remember, I love hearing from you. I'm @Cadavy on Twitter and Instagram. I have an author page on Facebook. You can say hello at david@cadavy.net. Good, bad, everything in between. I want to hear from you. Here is me and Rob Hunter. I'm here with my friend Rob Hunter, and I guess let's start with how it was that we met. Do you remember?
Yeah, I definitely remember us sitting down at a cafe in the Mission District of San Francisco. But you posted to Craigslist, and I responded. You were looking for, I think, a co-founder, right, or someone to help you out, or a programmer, something.
Yeah, I was looking it up the other day. I mean, it was more than 10 years ago. I think it was like possible technical co-founder or app developer, Facebook app developer, or possible technical co-founder. I posted up there. Yeah,
nice.
And you responded to that.
Yeah, and I wasn't that guy, or at least I didn't think I was. But I think I was still working with my friend Jesse at the time, and we were making this. We wanted to do a web app that would let you make web apps. And I thought, oh, like a good test would be this Craigslist guy who turned out to be you. And if our app could be used to help him make whatever Facebook app he wants to make, you know, that'd be great. So I met you down in the Mission.
Oh yeah. Now I'm starting to vaguely remember that, because I was building a Facebook app, and my Facebook app was like a Craigslist for Facebook. I think Facebook had just launched Marketplace, and it was bad, not satisfactory to me. And so I was trying to build a Craigslist that would use your social connections. That was back when everybody was trying to make Facebook apps. And then so I think I remember talking to you about using your app to build my Facebook app, right?
Yeah.
But then I was trying to pitch you to try to get you to be my technical co-founder.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think I sold you on using our product. Probably had something to do with the fact that our product was vaporware. I don't think it even ran, and it certainly didn't make Facebook apps. So if I wrote to you in that email like, "Hey, our software does that," it was only like our software could do that, you know, maybe.
And how did you end up at this point where you were trolling around Craigslist looking for people to work with?
Yeah, I was working at a company in Silicon Valley, kind of an enterprise software company, and I was a programmer there for almost 3 years. And I left my job in, I think it was July 2007, and I didn't leave under bad terms or anything. It was all, you know, no bridges burned, and in fact, I would say I was actually like a little bummed, like I was going to miss the place. It wasn't, I was so fed up with it, but I think that helped me realize that the decision was right, because I still wanted to do it. And what I wanted to do was do my own company. So I was working with another guy, a friend from college at the time. And we wanted to make, like I said, a web app for making web apps.
And I think you left around July 2017, right? Or 2007.
2007, exactly. Yeah. So that's, 10 years ago, you know, a little over 10 years ago at this point.
Yeah. And I got fired July 2007. And I mean, the moment that it happened, I was like, oh, this is great. I've been waiting for this.
So you had a different reaction than, or a different circumstance. Was it really like a firing? Were you like stealing notebook paper, copy paper?
No, I don't actually know exactly. We never really discussed it, which is kind of a weird thing. I guess I kind of saw it as like, you know, I'm working at startups, and you're going to work at a startup for 8 months, and something's going to happen. And I mean, actually, not too long after I left, then they like fired almost everybody, and you know, that company's not around anymore. So,
right,
but yeah. I was certainly had grown to not enjoy it very much, but I just didn't have the guts to quit. And then when I had my opportunity, it was instantaneous. You know, I said to my boss, like, oh, thank you. July 17th, 2007 is going to be a special day in my life. And then I went and I had like $130,000 in stock at the time, which is kind of absurd because I had just been putting away money, and then it was in Google and Apple. And so that worked out well, but it kind of took that much money for me to finally feel like, oh, okay, yeah, I can buy myself a year. So I cashed out $40,000 in stock and just said, okay, I'm just going to try stuff out. I'm not going to freelance or anything. So that's
did
how
you
I
have visions, like concrete vision. Like, did you know, like on day one, or like as you're, I don't know, walking home from this office with your little cardboard box and your desk plant or whatever it was, were you like, I know what I'm going to do, or were you thinking like, gosh, I wonder what I'm going to do? I mean, like specific project wise.
All that I knew was that I wanted to follow what I was curious about and just follow those things, make things based off of it, and see what happens, and then double down on the things that were working. I wanted to, I guess my main mission was, you know, I woke up that first morning, I like didn't have any, I had a whole day ahead of me. I could do whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
So, but I had been gotten so burned out working for other people that I had forgotten like what it was like to feel curious about something and feel interested in it. So I just, my idea was just fill up as much of my time as I can with something that I'm curious about, because that'll keep me from playing Guitar Hero all day.
Okay.
So that was kind of my vision. I mean, I think that I had grandiose visions of like, I'm going to be a billionaire and all this stuff, but I didn't have any possible like plan of exactly how that was going to happen, except for that I was going to build an app and maybe raise some money and something would happen. So, but how about you?
When I had a pretty clear idea, I think, because we actually applied to Y Combinator. So speaking of funding, we applied to Y Combinator, and it wasn't even the first time. This might have been like the second time applying. I applied kind of while I had the job, hoping, oh, we'd get in, and then I could quit the job. And I'd have, maybe that's analogous to your safety net. You know, you had your Google and Apple stock that made you feel okay about it. And I was like, oh, I'll get this funding and that'll be this kind of validation. And it won't be such a weird thing to leave, you know, a job you like. And we didn't get in, you know, again, I think for the second time, didn't get into Y Combinator, but I was like, you know, I think we should leave I should leave anyway. I think I've applied to Y Combinator for 4 times and been rejected 4 times. And I think three of them were for this web app, for making web app ideas. It's possible it was a 2 and 2 kind of deal, but I actually think I was rejected 3 times for this.
Now, when you got rejected from Y Combinator, every single time, were you like, yeah, I got this? I've sort of purposefully gone into things that I have a pretty good idea that I'm going to fail at. So for example, the first time that I pitched to South by Southwest, I was like, I don't think I have a very good idea, but I'm going to go through the process so that I can see the process in my mind, and then maybe next year I'll be that much better at applying for it and at making the decisions necessary to do a better job. And so the next year I tried it, I still didn't get accepted right away, but I got a book deal, which then got me speaking slots at South by Southwest.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good attitude, and I'm not sure I had that myself. I think I was confident I could at least make it through or have a good application, but it in retrospect, it might've just been like, I was good at writing the application, you know, but that's not the same thing as making a company. And so I think when we got to the interview phase, I think maybe the fact that we weren't ready, or that we didn't have the right idea, or maybe we weren't even the right team with a different idea, whatever it was, I think that came through now. So maybe I was a little overconfident. I mean, it was definitely disappointing each time.
I mean, did that get you down, getting rejected from Y Combinator 4 times?
Yes, definitely. I think I'm pretty good at, I think I'm pretty good about like recovering, like pretty quickly. Like I remember having, in Boston, the first time we got rejected, I do remember that we flew to Boston from Northern California, and we stayed at his brother's place, and we're kind of practicing. We had kind of totally changed the way we were going to pitch it the night before. And then, but I remember I was going to say about being, you know, getting over it the next day, we kind of had we were at some like coffee place chatting about it, and we were still pumped about it and like, well, you know, I'll still do it.
So going back to us sitting at, and I think it was Mission Creek Coffee, which is apparently no longer in business. It was on Valencia. And we're both sitting there trying to get, I'm trying to get you to be my technical co-founder. I think you're trying to build my app or
exactly,
something like
yeah.
that. And and you had been rejected from Y Combinator, which I guess we haven't clarified for people who don't know. It's a incubator program. They give you money and then they give you a lot of mentorship and everything.
Yeah.
But you decided to quit your job anyway. So yep. What were you seeing as your goals and options at that time? And how were you surviving?
Yeah, I had some money too. Maybe some ballpark. For some reason, I remember the amount, $50,000. But I honestly don't remember if that was like, if I had that in some stocks or if I was trying to save some of that too. But, you know, I had a nest egg. I worked at it, like I said, a nice job. So I had that kind of like financial kind of safety net. And I think I had just always, I would say since college, just I was going to start my own company at some point. And I kind of tried something, kind of a half-assed try in grad school. At the end of grad school, I left my PhD program after I got the master's to start a company with a friend. I was definitely excited when I left, even though we had just gotten rejected. I was like, okay, whatever. And by the time I met you, I don't know that I knew it at the time, but I think I was close to the end of the idea that I was just trying to sell you on or to get you to use our software. I was probably pretty close to switching over to trying out some iPhone stuff. I don't think I was too nervous. I mean, that might be a surprising statement, but I think I just was comfortable with my kind of support network of family, the fact that I was in a field. I kind of just got lucky with the computer science thing that it's a field that pays well. You know, it's like I started as a little kid programming basic stuff, and I'm certain I would have done this no matter what. It just happened that it's a thing that pays well. So I was like, I can always go back to a job, and in fact, I liked my job. At least I told myself that. I think it's true for the most part. So I think I was okay. I think I was in a pretty good spot for the most part. There were some dark days. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and you were thinking, okay, I can just go back to a job at any point.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I know my mindset at the time was if somebody, I mean, I actually remember a friend of mine, she was like, yeah, you're going to get a job within 6 months. And kind of my gears started turning in my brain. I'm trying to think about cause and effect or whatever. It basically went in my mind, like all the way to me, like lying face down in a gutter, dead. and I was like, that's not going to happen.
Okay. So you,
my mind was completely made up.
Okay. And so that probably was a motivator for you, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I don't know. I think that you can do it either way. I think that those are two different styles of doing it. But I do think that, and what, it's 10 years later. Like, have I made it? Kind of. We can get into that.
Yeah, I do want to chat about that. But yeah, I mean, in some sense, you certainly have. Well, is it you have not gone back and got a, you know, quote unquote, real job, right? Since mid-2007, and I have not either.
I mean, I haven't even gone back to like consulting even. No. So I'm doing fine. It's just I've been working for a couple of years on a couple of things that I have yet to really bear the fruit that they might. And I had some really good years in there, especially after Design for Hackers. But yeah, I said to my friend after she said it to me, I looked at her, I said, I would rather be dead.
Oh, geez.
And I meant it. I was pretty intense as far as like, this is what I'm going to do. I had made up my mind entirely. And I mean, who knows if certain events would have happened, I might've changed my mind, I guess. But in my mind, my mind was completely made up. There was no going back. And so I don't know whether that's the way to do it, but I didn't feel like I had a choice, really.
So can I ask then, do you feel, because that, I think the fact that I'm like, well, I could always do this, is related to, you know, the idea that, oh, I feel like I can kind of get over stuff quick. It's like, you know, like I'm little, pretty even keeled. Maybe I didn't fully commit to it. It has to be that way. Do you find that if something doesn't go your way, you can rebound pretty well? Or is it tougher because it's like, oh, because of the I'd rather be dead mentality? Does that make sense?
I think during that period of time, I didn't necessarily have a lot of like crushing blows because I was doing so many different things. I had my eggs in so many baskets, so to speak, which might not have been the best strategy, but it was, like I said, I was trying to follow my curiosity. So if my curiosity was taking me a million different places, that was where I was going to go. And I was just going to trust that it was going to connect at some point in the future. Yeah. And so, like, for example, the Facebook app that I was building at the time, which was a Craigslist that uses your social connections through Facebook, uses a social graph. You know, I ended up hiring, getting a developer/co-founder for it. We built the app. It was doing pretty well, but it relied upon this, you know, these profile boxes that were on Facebook profiles at the time for like advertising the listings. You know, I'm looking for a roommate, I'm selling my computer, I'm selling my car. And then one day Facebook just changed their algorithm. And yeah. I still have a picture of the usage graph. Like it went from, it was growing, growing, growing steadily. I had people asking me about it, like, hey, that's going really viral and everything. And then it just was gone. Yeah. And we never fixed it. And I never felt like there was no moment of like, oh, I really failed for that. I mean, I guess I've had that in the past, like a couple of years, probably the biggest failure that I've experienced where I was like, wow, I really failed at this, was a couple of years ago when I wrote a book proposal and then it wasn't well received, but now I've revised it. It's taken me a year and a half or so and we'll see how that goes now. But in any case, that book is getting written regardless. I didn't feel like when people would ask me about failures, I wouldn't really know what to say because I didn't really view anything as a failure. I really viewed it as just a bunch of different experiments. So maybe that was something that protected me and that mentality of do or die.
I think that also might be a good strategy for just kind of getting started or just trying it. You know, oh, if this is just an experiment, why don't I just try it rather than like, oh, this is a whole big like life mission, quest, startup, some, you know, like, I don't know, make it, break it down to smaller pieces kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess part of it was perhaps because like that app at the time, I did think it was going to be successful. I think I was pretty certain that it would be because I really committed to it for a while there, but I was trying other things at the time as well. But that wasn't my life's mission. My life's mission was to rediscover my curiosity, to follow it at all costs, to trust that what I learned along the way would eventually connect into something that was one of a kind or unusual, that would that I would not only I would love doing it, but then I would just be making money during the day doing things, filling up as much of my day as possible with a feeling of satisfaction. So that was my mission. So it didn't really matter to me how that was going to happen at that time.
Yeah, rediscovering your own curiosity at all costs. I like that. That's pretty awesome. Did you ever feel like you had made it, like a kind of a premature, you know, mission accomplished kind of thing in the, let's say your it was through a friend, right? Is that the name? That's the name of the project, the startup.
That was the app. Yeah.
So did you at some point, like you're looking at the graph, you know, before the screenshot you have where it started going down, were you like, oh, I think I've made it. I think I'm done. Or I don't know if done's the right word, but something like that.
No, not really. I mean, I do remember one thing. It was that I told you this, that I think that before we met, and we haven't gotten to the part that we were basically meeting at a different cafe every day and working all day for almost a year after that moment. But I think leading up to that moment, that was the time when I decided I was going to change my schedule. And I basically, so that I wouldn't get distracted during the day, shifted everything. So I would start working at like 8 p.m. or something like that. And I would just stay up until 4 a.m. and then I would sleep until noon. And that way I would be working in the night when I wouldn't be getting emails. I wouldn't be on Facebook and all that stuff. So during that time, I was like you were saying about the Facebook API, I was learning everything I could about the Facebook API. And I wasn't a developer really. So I was building app specs. And so everything that I had to build within the app specs, and I basically had to describe, this is how this app works. And this is, here's the pieces from the API that you're going to use to do all these things. And that was a reconnection, not just with curiosity, but a reconnection with quality. I really had felt over the years that I had been forced to do things at kind of a breakneck speed, because that's the way things seem to work at a lot of companies. Like, people don't want to really take their time and do things really well. And so I got so much satisfaction out of just making that the most kick-ass spec doc that you've ever seen. That was just satisfying, just to do something up to my own standard of quality at that point in time. That was what I just really wanted from that, at the base level.
Yeah. And do you were pitching a bunch of developers, and is that like the people responding to it? You're actually trying to get them to do it, like to hire someone or to partner with someone, right?
The guy that I ended up working with as kind of a co-founder, I paid him a little bit, but I mean, it was, I didn't realize, like, I remember going to dinner with him and telling him about the idea, and he had seen the specs and everything. And he just like really deliberately, kind of folds his hands and tilts his head, and he's like, "I'm interested in working on your project." Oh. Just like very seriously. And I guess I didn't realize at the time, you know, he was an amazing developer. He works at Google now. I mean, he was working for a company that it would get bought by Google. And I didn't realize like what an accomplishment it was to sort of recruit him and get him willing to work on it as a discount
right.
at the time.
Yeah. That's the dream, right? If you don't have that venture capital money to find that diamond before they know they're a diamond, right?
Yeah. So basically after we met in over Craigslist at this cafe, then somehow we ended up getting into this pattern where I was going to a different cafe every day, and I would just text you, and then you would magically show up like 20 minutes later.
Yeah, I must have been to the Mission, but I feel like you showed me the like Mission like hipster coffee shop scene, which I've since ashamed to say that's like my favorite place to work, like either the Mission or like something like that. I basically, in all the random cities I'm at in these days, I'll just find like look up the coffee shops on Yelp, click. They have a new feature on Yelp where they categorize the photos by like interior or food shots. And I always go for interior just to kind of see, okay, do I see laptops? Like what does it look like?
We're going to take a quick break. I'm really thrilled to have Skillshare as a sponsor of Love Your Work. I know that so many listeners out there are curious types like me that never want to stop learning. That's why Skillshare is great for you. It's just like it sounds. You share skills, or people share skills with you. It's an online learning community with over 17,000 classes in design, business, many more things. You can learn street photography, business analytics, social media marketing. And you know that I'm a big Seth Godin fan. You're probably a big Seth Godin fan too. Skip the Netflix tonight. Take Seth's course. It's called the Modern Marketing Workshop.
You and I could walk into any business school in this country, to any marketing class in this country, and that's what's being taught. That what's being taught is a framework to think about what you do when you have something you want to market. And this course is about something else. This course says, market what works.
With Skillshare, you get unlimited access to Seth's class and then also all the other classes for one low monthly price. You never have to pay per class again. Skillshare is giving my listeners a month of unlimited access absolutely free. Go to Skillshare.com/loveyourwork to redeem your free month. Keep in mind that Skillshare helps keep this podcast free. So please, if they interest you, make sure you go to Skillshare.com/loveyourwork so that way they know that you heard it here.
So you invented the term I don't know. Have you mentioned this officially, Moworking? I don't know if it really caught on between more than between you and me, but that was the name for what we did, right? Mobile working.
It didn't catch on a lot. I mean, co-working was pretty new then. And then we were, I just remember we just started a wiki that you and I think were the main contributors to. And we were just adding cafes. And our kind of criteria was, all right, is the atmosphere good? Is the is there Wi-Fi? Do you are there outlets?
Yeah.
Do they give you the stink eye if you sit there for a few hours?
Yeah. These are all critical. I would say the only thing that's changed now, all of it's relevant except the Wi-Fi. I don't usually worry about because I just do what's it called? Tethering. If there's nothing easy.
Well, oddly, coffee wasn't one of the criteria. I don't drink coffee. I never have.
I never thought about that. You're right. It never occurred to me to rate the coffee. I actually started coffee at some point during this period. Now I drink probably too much coffee. Yeah.
So what were the other cafes we were going to? I think there was K-Tow, which is not there anymore. There was Cafe Petra, which is gone. Ritual.
Max, Ritual. That was probably like fancy hipster. Yeah, I was there maybe a month ago. I'm definitely still there.
Maxwell's
was that Max. I really like that. I got their egg and cheese bagels all the time.
And it kind of got to where I sort of got sensitive to, oh, what mood am I in? And fortunately, it seemed like you didn't care. But I would kind of be like, based upon the mood or whatever I wanted to work on, I would kind of choose the cafe. So if I really wanted to like get creative, maybe I'm writing a blog post or something like that, I would go to Cafe Triste in, if I'm saying that right, my Italian's not that great, in North Beach. And it was kind of like this Italian place. They had a good chai and it had like an artsy atmosphere. That was like the only place in North Beach I can remember. I would go all the way there just to go to that cafe.
I had one actually in North Beach. It was like, is it my white whale? Is that the expression? I don't know. Anyways, I'll explain. And then you can tell me if I'm saying that right. But it was I just had this vision that I would, once I was successful or once I had completed whatever goal I was going for, and it had to be something big, I would go to... It's a place that's unfortunate. It's now been purchased by Starbucks. I actually don't even think it exists anymore. I think they shut them all down. But anyway, my vision was to go and like not bring my computer and read a book. That would be my like, I made it kind of thing. I succeeded in life.
So you fantasized about going to this place in North Beach with a book without your computer and that you would have made it when that happened and then never happened.
Right. It wouldn't be that doing that would be, it would be, I would choose as kind of reward. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I made it. I'm feeling good.
Did you have a goal in mind that the time at which you would allow yourself to go do that?
I don't know. I did make this spreadsheet chart, which was like, this was a few years down the road, which was like daily, a 30-day window of averaged daily revenue. And I would have kind of like goals based on levels. You know, if you made $50 a day, I would get to do kind of like a reward, like a treat.
And then so it was the money problem we would talk about. All right, well, how are we going to get? I think my thing was that I wanted to just. I wanted more time and space. I wanted some way to make money with as little time as possible. I think I had read the 4-hour work week at that point.
Okay.
And a little time as possible so that I would have the space to then keep following my curiosity because I realized it was going to take a long time before that would pay off.
Yeah. I think very similar with me. And I also had read the, I don't, whenever that came out, I think I totally was like, I think it like his marketing worked like just the way it was supposed to, him being Tim Ferriss, that I think I literally saw a Google ad and that title spoke to me. And I've learned since then that he like tested that title, you know?
Well, yeah, I remember. So with the 4-hour work week, it was a friend lent me that book and it must've been August 2007 or so. It was like after I was kind of deciding how I was going to spend my time and everything. And so my friend lent me that book and it totally changed. It's funny. This is the way that things work with the way that creator models work. Tim Ferriss has maybe gotten. I never bought the book, really. So he changed my life. I made hundreds of thousands of dollars based off of his advice. And he's gotten like $4 from me over the last 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, you're like, I feel like you're a, I don't know what they call it. Yeah. I mean, like you should be a, what do they call that? Like a spokes, you know, like a perfect example of a
case study.
Case study. There we go. Yeah.
He wants the people that are making 100K a month or something, I think what he's going for. But I've submitted to be a case study, I think probably multiple times, but no cigar. So the money problem.
The money problem, right. And solving the money problem, right?
Yeah. So how did you go about solving the money problem?
Well, I think that's a tough. So that question kind of assumes that I have, right? Or you're saying attempt to solve the money problem. I don't feel like I've solved it, but I've definitely made some headway. I've made headway in ways that.
What would be solving the money problem for you?
That's a good question. I think part of the problem might be if it is a problem is that it's I have not defined that specifically, but in a very general sense, it's similar to what you were saying about being able to pursue, you know, follow your creativity. I think many people have goals of like retiring on the beach, and while I like beaches, retirement just I don't know that never. I'm sure I might, you know, might change my opinion when I'm 60 or 70 or something like that. But that is not a goal of mine. But not having to work in a particular way or even at all, even though I suspect I would choose to, is kind of the thing. So the flexibility that money would give, or that solving the money problem, to use that phrase, is what I want.
How did you begin to try to solve the money problem?
I think... not in a very specific way. I think I probably did zero of the steps that may have been outlined in a 4-hour work week. I think there's maybe you could say there's two ways that come to mind to do it. There's the like start kind of a big ambitious project that isn't itself focused on making money. It's you know, kind of the VC model or one of them where you're just trying to make something big and then you can figure out how to make money later, you know, like Facebook did. And, you know, that's kind of what Scribbler was, the web app. Oh, sorry, I'm getting confused. That's actually what both the web app for making web apps, which I think was called Fractal App, and Scribbler, which was the leaving location-based notes. Both of those didn't have clear monetization plans, but I imagined if, you know, with enough usage, I could. Then I eventually teamed up with Mark, my current business partner, and we started consulting. And then after we did that, we started working on our own apps and eventually started making like revenue, like recurring daily revenue, passive, or, you know, we can talk about if there's even such a thing as passive income, but certainly through some definition, passive income. And that's when it started. So now that I've said that and thinking about what I've said, I don't think I was very good about like, oh, okay, I want to solve this money problem. How do I do that? I did it a very like back ass words way. Or attempted it. Were you more concrete? Did you have like, okay, this is what I can do? Were you like, okay, I'm going to start by making this project, which is going to give me passive income so that I can do the next thing and like, you know, increase the passive income or something like that?
To an extent, but not in a, I kind of get the sense that maybe for you, that if somebody would have pointed in an idea for you and you could, and been like, do this, and then after 6 months, you're going to make X dollars and you could probably just do it. I was not capable of that. To me, it was still the whole curiosity thing. Like I had to have something that would motivate me, that I was motivated to do, because that was like I had reached the end of my rope as far as like, there was no other way I could operate. I had tried working for other people, and then it's just like, you're working somebody else's initiative. Maybe you don't feel like doing this thing. Right. And so it was, for me, it was very much, try a lot of different things, try things that have a chance to make the passive money, but keep checking in on it. So I would try, I had so many different projects going on at the time. You know, I had the dating app, the dating blog, mess around with Mo working. I had a roommate meetup that I would run, which actually led to Through a Friend, which was the Facebook app that I did. I was trying to make like a GTD markup language, which wasn't necessarily a business, but I have some mock-ups of productivity apps that I had tried. And, you know, and I would set up blogs here and there just anytime I had an idea. And then I would switch around from these different things and just check in with them every once in a while. So eventually what happened was about after a year of wandering around, I left and went to Chicago. I could get cheaper rent. I could get my own apartment. I could get a 2-bedroom apartment for the price of the room that I was crammed in San Francisco. And my strategy, and I have drawings of this, even of my drawings of my plan. It was like, okay, I'm going to bill 10 hours a week of freelance. That's my goal. Mm-hmm. Bill 10 hours a week of freelance. And then the rest of the time I'm going to spend on passive revenue. And hopefully that passive revenue will pick up. And at that point in time, I'll be more free to follow the things that I was curious about. And so what happened was that as soon as I moved to Chicago, I almost instantly, somebody from Odesk, which is now Upwork, like the company, I wasn't like freelancing for Upwork. Somebody contacted me. Great timing, you know, really pretty fortunate, pretty lucky. And they basically needed about 10 hours a week. And I was charging, I think, $100 an hour. And then the rest of the time, I would just tinker around, just trying to find where there was money in the things I already had. Like, I already had a blog where I had a page about a cyst that you get in your lip called a mucoseal.
Okay.
That was getting like 20,000 visits a month, and everybody needed $1,000 surgery. And so I was like calling oral surgeons to try to sell them ads, but none of them would do it. And I just like couldn't squeeze any money out of that. And then I think the first passive money that I really started making, which was, you know, well after I started the online dating blog, was a blog post I had written that was how to transfer your iTunes library from one computer to another. And I had all the instructions laid out. I was getting a ton of traffic on it. I don't know, 17,000, 20,000 visits a month on just this one page. And it was just a matter of kind of poking around and asking people like, what do I do? How do I, how can I get some, how can I make money off of this asset that I have? And somebody said, try affiliate software. Sure enough, there was affiliate software that transferred an iTunes library from one computer to another. And so I signed up for the affiliate program. I just put a direct link from the blog post to the checkout cart, didn't make a landing page or anything. I was just like, yeah, the instructions are here, but if you want to pay for software that helps you, do that here. And then I left. I went on a date, came back 3 hours later, had an email that was like, you just made $26. Wow. And that was the moment. I mean, a few days went by. I thought my friends were playing a prank on me or something. And that was the moment I started making any passive revenue. And then I believe that's when, you know, I went to visit San Francisco, and we met at Ritual Roasters. Okay. And had a conversation where, you know, I got to where I was making a couple thousand a month off of that iTunes transfer.
Oh, I 100% remember this. Yeah. No, it was big because you... And I didn't... Okay, a couple thousand a month. I didn't remember the number, but it was basically like rent and food, or that's the way I remember it. Like, that was like, it was almost like a tipping point where your passive income was actually like supporting you. And so, you know, if it continued, you could do this indefinitely, which is huge, you know.
And where were you at that point? I kind of felt like that was when we sat down and had coffee, that there was sort of like a, hey, you know, like we kind of made it.
Right,
like,
right.
What, we ate shit for 6 months or a year, but, you know, now both of us are making money.
Well, but what year was this? And then I can tell you kind of where I was.
2008. I know that by like February 2010, I was maybe making $2,200 a month.
Okay, so maybe that was it. That's right around, we were about to release Hit Tennis. But anyway, I was before that, like 2008, end of that, I was just about to meet Mark, my business partner, and I took a screenshot of my checking account, and it was like 38 cents. In my mind, I saved $50,000. I don't think I went through $50,000 that quick. But anyway, the point is I did not have very much money. But I remember like, it wasn't like a dark day so much, I think, because I was like, okay, I'll figure this out. I think I did a Craigslist gig to kind of get some cash. But I eventually ran into Mark at a meetup, and we kind of hit it off and just started consulting. He had this client and he felt like he needed help. Everyone was just as much as an expert of, you know, iPhone development. You couldn't possibly have 10 years experience because it just started, you know, 6 months ago. And so we were on the forefront of that. And so that was just like easy pickings. Like we always like, oh, at some point for our consulting business, we'll have to do like a marketing push where we contact everyone on LinkedIn that we know to see, but we just never did that because we always had like, oh, you know, something in the queue, someone who contacted us. It was just a kind of lucky time to do that. But I think, yeah, probably when you and I met that one time and like we were feeling pretty good was maybe after Hit Tennis 2, which was kind of our first big app that kind of took off and was like, you know, good amount of income. And it was pretty exciting. But I also just thought of something I think we probably were thinking like, oh yeah, we kind of made it, but it's a tough business, you know, because it's constantly going up and down, you know, and there have been, I think I asked you earlier if you felt like you'd made it with this one part through a friend. And I think I asked that because there have been definite times when I was like, oh, I think I've made it. And then it becomes clear, you know, a few months later, like, I was just at like a local peak or something.
All right. As far as so basically you and Mark started consulting and then also started building your own games and stuff.
Yeah. It was a while after we started consulting, but yeah, Mark, I really didn't have I did not have the vision of that, but Mark, you know, we were at kind of the coffee place thread. We were at Axis. I think it's called Axis Cafe. Does that sound right? I might have that name wrong. It's in the Mission, of course. And it's kind of a restaurant coffee place. But anyways, it's another one in the kind of Mission Potrero area. And we were there and he was like, hey, I think we should turn my tennis iPhone kind of demo app that he had made. He said he wanted to make it free and turn it into a full game and kind of bring it into the company. And I said, sure, let's do it. And that turned out to be a huge, very, very good idea because it allowed us to kind of turn down our consulting, eventually totally stop it and start doing just our own apps, you know, making their income full time.
How long of a transition was that before you could get down?
Gosh, yeah, I think it wasn't. It might have been a year, but so it wasn't like an overnight thing. There was one sort of overnight successful moment where the app went to number two free app in the whole store US, and that's. So we were getting just tons of downloads, but we didn't put any.
Yeah. So it was a free app that people could buy power-ups.
Exactly. Yeah. In the case of Hit Tennis 2, and it was called 2, it was really the first one. Hit Tennis 1 was in the store. Mark made it all himself, but it really was more of a demo app, just the kind of proof of concept. And yeah, freemium, they call it. So most players just play for free, enjoy themselves. I'm kind of that style of player myself, but some people kind of want to spend money to like get extra stuff and you could buy energy drinks in the app. But when it went to number two in the app store, we were actually at a conference, an iPhone, a small iPhone conference. But we were, you know, it's kind of a fun, like ego stroking wise, kind of a fun time to be number two in the app store. We're like, hey, look at us. And the problem was we had not yet implemented anything you could buy. There were no energy drinks. And we had not yet implemented ads. So we were getting, you know, thousands, I don't remember, but a lot of downloads per day. I think we got like a million in like a week or two or something like that, downloads. And we had no way of making money off those people. So it took off at some point a little faster than we thought. I remember talking to this one guy at the conference. He's like, you guys should go up to, we would rent a hotel room for the conference. He's like, you should just go to the hotel room right now and like implement ads at least. Like, this is crazy. So we went up and I think we stayed up and tried to get ads working and tried to ship it. But Apple took a long time at that point. You couldn't just, it wasn't a couple of days. It was sometimes like a week or two, maybe 2 weeks to get an app approved. And I don't remember I don't think we were at number two by the time we did. But anyways, we still, you know, it settled down and then we kept working at it and got the revenue.
Well, that had to at least give you the confidence to do all the work that would be necessary to make it paid and put all the energy drinks and all that stuff in there. Because otherwise you're kind of, you have this game, maybe it's not that popular. You do all these things to make it monetizable, but then it never pays off.
Yep.
It's a lot easier if you already have a bunch of users.
I think that's totally right. And I think it's with the freemium model, other than the way that I think it in the app world, I think it tends to work as it does in other areas. But I think having a bunch of users, you know, because people like free stuff. And so we were, over the years, it does seem like we've been pretty good at finding apps we could make where we could get a good number of users. The question has been like, you know, of course, retaining them and can you get some of them to pay for stuff? But when you have a bunch of users, you know, thousands of people using the app, it's kind of just like a more fun position to be from. It's like, oh, we can try this. And then suddenly 1,000 people, you know, or thousands of people could be using it. We could see if it looks like a promising way to go.
It's funny when you were talking about how like nobody was an expert on iPhone development at the time because it was brand new. It's funny how there's these opportunities that come up around every once in a while. Like for me, when I started working on the Facebook app, everybody was working on Facebook apps. Facebook was kind of like, yeah, make Facebook apps. And it seemed like they were going to use it as a way to see like, oh, what's good? And then they can kind of promote what's good. But it seems like what they did was just have this sort of gold rush thing and then kind of said, this didn't work out.
No, I think that's totally right. It was like a gold rush. And then there was a little bit of gold for the people who happened to get there, right?
But iOS development turned out the other way.
It became like a thing. Now, I think it's hard to see. Yeah, very much. I think it turned the other way. And they have been pretty good about only kind of extending. It really comes down to that notification change, right? There were a few changes that Facebook did that I think really like crippled the app. So the profile one you mentioned, like you couldn't be on the profile page, I think it was. And I think Apple has kind of only added to the things developers could do. Because it started, like when it launched, you couldn't even write native apps. You had to do them through a web app. And they let you have an icon, but that's it. And then they gave you pretty much full access to the native stuff. And then they kept adding stuff to the developer. So yeah, it's done pretty well. Now it used to be, I think, talking about the gold rush, I think there still are some of those aspects where there was a while where a lot of people, not me, but there were a lot of just like indie solo or very small teams, like making a lot of money in the early days. They just happened to hit it right, you know? And I think a bunch of those were like pretty gimmicky. And I think people are now used to their iPhone. It's kind of just become a part of it that those gimmicks don't work as often.
Based upon our digging into the past and remembering everything that we did during our wander year, what would you say was the final message to wrap up our conversation today?
A wander year is a great way of saying it because for me, and I do think you were much more directed at doing the things, but even you, even the great David Cadavy, I think we really were both wandering. And the trick is try a bunch of stuff. And God, I mean, just like this conversation here, it's like, I've forgotten about all these things that, you know, that you did, that I did. And it's like, wow, there was a lot of stuff in there. It wasn't for me as simple as just, oh, we made a tennis game and an emoji game. It was way, way more than that. And I'm not sure you can plan for that other than just, you know, keep trying stuff.
I think that's an astute observation. I also think that, like, if you have the mentality that you're going to just go do something and it's going to work, that can actually prevent you from starting in the first place. So I think having the mentality that there's always tomorrow, there's always more that you're going to do, that it kind of reduces that starting resistance. All right. This has been a lot of fun. Where can people get more of you?
I don't have a book. I don't have a blog. I've been thinking about getting a blog, but they can find me at you've made fun of this Twitter handle before, David, but they can find me at Vegas Hacker.
And they can also download Hit Tennis and Emoji Me in the App Store. Thanks for coming on.
I hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane with Rob and I. I tried to keep this conversation about our different approaches to bootstrapping. Rob also shared some great lessons learned from building an iOS app with 40 million downloads. And that's in the bonus material, which you can find on LYW Elite.
The one caution I'd have is that when you try to validate something, what's the difference between your test and the real thing? And I could think of at least one big deal in the test we ran.
You can join Love Your Work Elite at lywelite.com. If you want to hear more about making it through the tough start of an entrepreneurial endeavor, listen to Seth Godin on episode 77. Seth shared more than I've ever heard before about his early days.
I was afraid. I was deeply, deeply afraid. I was wounded. I was a failure. The promises I was making to the people around me, I was having trouble keeping. I wasn't able to persuade my clients to give me money. And I really wanted to run away.
Again, Seth is on episode 77. I work hard to help you crack the code on fulfilling work. If Love Your Work is helping you, there are some ways you can help support the show and make it even better. One is to subscribe. This is especially effective on Apple Podcasts or iTunes because it boosts rankings and helps others find the show. I know many of you listen on Overcast because you're the early adopter types. So even if you don't listen on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please subscribe there anyway. Subscribe in your iPhone, your iPad, your Apple TV, your computer. The more devices, the better. It really helps. Apple Podcast ratings help too. Just go to cadavy.net/apple, click on write a review, and click on the star rating. You don't even have to write a review. It just takes a couple of seconds. You can also join Love Your Work Elite. You'll get access to episodes before everyone else. You could even get ad-free interviews weeks in advance, and you can get your name or business mentioned in the credits of the show. For details, go to lywelite.com. That's lywelite.com. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by top Love Your Work Elite members such as Arif Akhtar and Ed Stanfield of startwithclarity.com. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for the show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.